Tonight on Arena, The County the Lovebirds, When Women Won and Women Make Film are the movies up for review. And where do I start with Stanley Kubrick? Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Thursday night means it's movie night here in Arena. We have four new films available to stream direct to your living room from the extreme comfort that is of your very own sofa. The County is an Icelandic tale of rural decline, but with a couple of laughs thrown in, they tell us. The Irish documentary When Women Won tells the story of the Together for Yes campaign, and we look at Mark Cousins' mammoth Women Make Film documentary on film, female filmmaking, lasting hundreds of hours, in fact. But let's start with The Lovebirds, which was scheduled for cinema release last month, but has now made its way onto Netflix. Our reviewers tonight, Sarah Taff McGuire and Stephen Boyd. I suppose, Sarah, can you give me the basic setup at the beginning of this? It looks like it's a romantic comedy, a straightforward romantic comedy, but things get pretty sticky fairly quickly.
Yeah, romantic comedy with a murderous twist, I think is how you describe it. We have Leilani, who is played by Issa Rae, and Gibran, who is Kumail Nanjiani. They're going out. We meet them on their first date 4 years later. They're living together. They're squabbling. They're getting ready to go. They're heading over to a friend's house. They're arguing. They realise they're not meant to be together. They look into each other's eyes and they run a man over. This man is a bicycle driver, and then a stranger comes, hijacks a car, and then goes and runs over the cyclist again, yeah, and again and again. So then they're left in a situation where they've got a dead body in front of them, the actual murder having fled, and then two witnesses looking at them saying, what the hell is going on?
Well, let's listen to a clip, actually, which gives us precisely that moment when, you know, they think it's a police officer that got into the car, by the way, but then he runs over the cyclist three or four times, as you say. So we know we're in a kind of a screwball territory. But here's the moment when the hipsters, played by Catherine Cohen and Barry Rothbart, rather, they're the two witnesses. They come across Issa Rae playing Leilani and Kumail Nanjiani playing Gibran, who are trying to explain what happened, in fact.
We didn't kill him.
Well, he just said he killed him.
No, I said I hit him with my car.
Clearly it worked. You killed the guy with your car.
I was driving and we broke up and I got distracted and I ran through a red light. Just
but then this guy came in. A weird mustache.
I helped him a little bit with my map, which I meant was definitely a mistake.
He took our car. He ran over him.
We need to call
him. And then back and forth 10 times. And now I've got a guy getting blood on me and the car's a fucking murder weapon.
What are you doing?
I'm calling 911.
Please don't do that. We would never hurt anyone.
He'd like to report a murder or whatever.
We didn't murder anybody!
Stop!
You stop! Oh my God, the police aren't gonna believe us. Do you know how stupid we sound?
The citizens arrest.
Okay. What is that?
It's an arrest for the citizens.
Can you do that? Can you do that?
On the count of three, okay?
On the count of three, what? What is that face? I can't reach your face. Just say it.
On the count of three.
What?
1, 2, 3, go!
What?
The guy just ran for it?
Gibran!
Okay, the guy's name is Gibran.
Run, Leilani!
And the girl's name's actually Leilani.
Shit!
Okay, she's running too now. She's just happens to be African-American, and he just happens to be a person of color as well. But I don't, like, think they're murderers because they're minorities. I think they're murderers because they literally just killed a guy and he's playing.
Oh, fuck.
There we go. Catherine Cohen, Barry Rothbart as the two witnesses, and Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani as the couple who essentially will take us right through this film, The Lovebirds, the couple being Leilani and Gibran. We get a sense, Stephen Boyd, from that clip, particularly the opening section of it, that it's quite a frantic pace that we're dealing with in terms of, yeah, vocal or verbal delivery at any rate here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and kind of like you can tell from the clip you just played there, Sean, sometimes it's funny and sometimes it isn't. So like I was smiling during particularly at the end of that clip, but a lot of it I was kind of just watching, and I felt like that while I was watching the film. In some ways it reminds me of an old fashioned kind of screwball comedy. I think you kind of mentioned the word a few minutes ago, and it kind of does almost have that screwball-esque sense to it, where the romance is not really as important as the screwball element. And that, you know, goes right back to the 1930s and, you know, Bringing Up Baby and, you know, crazy films like that. It doesn't really have the romance or the humor, I think, of Nanjiani's last film, which was The Big Sick, which he did with the director Michael Showalter. And it doesn't really, I suppose, you know, hit the high notes of that film, but there are plenty of gags. A lot of it, though, I feel like it's maybe not the most progressive film in the world, even though it's in terms of diversity, it's obviously really at the forefront of that with, you know, it's great to see someone of Pakistani heritage and then someone of Senegalese heritage play in a rom-com like this.
Yeah, I'll come back to you on the specifics of the two stars and what they have done previous to this. But Sarah, that screwball aspect, if you're going to go for screwball comedy, you're going to need to deliver everything fast and furious, but never overlap, because every word is really important and you want to get the jokes. What about the plot here? How screwball is the plot?
Fairly screwball. I mean, there's a lot of dashing around for some reason. So their whole idea of running away doesn't quite make a whole lot of sense. Well, it's not really supposed to. It's just meant to be this madcap comedy. But there's a huge amount of dashing and running for reasons and that get lost fairly quickly. And I mean, that madness can be enjoyable. It can be fun once we have characters that are interesting. And by the way, they do sound interesting. Gibran is a documentary filmmaker, Leilani, a successful advertiser, but we learn kind of very little about them. And as Stephen was mentioning, when we have this dashing, not particularly interesting characters, and then comedy, which just doesn't always land. It's very easy to disconnect or you know, to sort of switch off and become confused and not engaged at all. So it's silly and it's light, but it's, and that's the way it's meant to be. But the humor just, and even the romance or warmth or interest in the characters just isn't there to maintain that interest, unfortunately.
Tell me a little bit more then, Stephen, about Kumail Nanjiani and Issa Rae. Nanjiani has already he's been nominated for an Oscar. What was that for?
Yeah, that was for The Big Sick. So Kumail Nanjiani is actually, I suppose, particularly to younger listeners who probably know him more from watching Silicon Valley over the last few years. It was a HBO production. And, you know, he was really incredibly funny in that. And he's a writer as well. And he's definitely kind of benefited from, you know, the greater diversity that we're seeing across, you know, cinema and in television. He was, I think he was listed actually as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in 2018. And The Big Sick, I suppose, his previous film, which got him well known and got him the Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay, that came about with his wife, Emily Gordon, who co-wrote the film. And it was kind of semi-autobiographical about them coming together and the kind of racial misunderstandings that went on. Whereas, you know, that's not present in this film. But, you know, Issa Rae, she's really well known as well, I'd say, particularly to younger listeners, or definitely people under 30, because she's become incredibly well known for The Adventures of an Awkward Black Girl. And she really is quite a good physical comedian. She's really quite funny. And the two actors actually are the two, for me, they were the best thing about the film. I kind of didn't mind watching them. And they brought more laughs out than perhaps some other actors could have.
All right.
Yeah, they were easily the thing that came out shining from this.
What does overall, did you get enough from it to sustain it across? And it is only an hour and a half. It felt a bit longer than that to me when I was watching it, I have to admit. Sarah, did it work for you and stars?
Yeah, well, I'm saying 2 out of 5 stars. In fact, just as you mentioned there, it's an hour and a half and it felt like it could have ended at 2 separate points. We're like, ah, and there it is over. And oh, wait, tacking on this other bit. Okay, now that's over. And ultimately we came to the same ending and just it felt like, oh, Jane, we'd want to make that a bit longer. Should we throw on a couple more scenes that really didn't add anything and just made you sort of descend into farce without the humour? So 2 out of 5 stars for me.
2 from you. Stars from you, Stephen?
I give it 3 because there were some moments I did think was funny, but in particular, it's nice to see a genre that was the preserve of middle-class white characters and audiences, you know, changing up a little bit. And I suppose I want to give it a bit of support for that. So 3 out of 5.
Yeah, but we do want to laugh as well if it's a screwball comedy. Okay, so that's our first film then, Lovebirds, which is available on Netflix. Yeah. Let's move on to The County. This is from an Icelandic filmmaker called Grimur Hakonarsson. You couldn't have a different temperature of film from the one we've just spoken about, Sarah. What's the basic setup here?
Basically, this is set in Dalsmini, which is rural northern Iceland. It's a husband and wife team, Inga, played by Arndís Strón Egilsdóttir, and she's an Icelandic TV actor, and her husband is Reynir, Hinrik Olafsson. They're running a small dairy farm together, which has been the family for generations. Life is tough, and the pair are working 7 days a week. At night time, they barely have time to say to each other, oh, did you have time to call the inseminator for the cows? And they're working, and they're hugely in debt despite working hard. The co-op sort of is in charge of the area. They sell all their milk to the co-op. They must buy all their products from the co-op. Earlier, the co-op had really encouraged them to modernize and to sort of automate a lot of the processes within the farm, and it's left them hugely in debt, which they simply cannot repay. They're forced to buy everything from the co-op, which is an artificially high price. And then, unfortunately, Reynir dies in unusual circumstances, and we're sort of left wondering, is it suicide? Right. Is it a tragic accident? So his family are left wondering what's happened. And then Inga is left to run the farm herself and to deal with the co-op, who start acting in increasingly mafia ways through a lot of atmosphere. They start showing up at her house, start doing the work in the farm with no mention. Right. Even at Rainier's funeral, they're all sitting together, tightly together. So yeah. Inga has a sense that things aren't right whatsoever. She writes an article about this behaviour and about the fact that everything has to come through the co-op, and it's them who are essentially keeping the people in debt and are threatening to take over farms.
All right. Let me go to Stephen with it at this point, Sarah. And that is really kind of, nothing happens in some ways for a long, long time, and it's very silent. Just this beautiful glacial Icelandic landscape is what I find myself looking at any rate. And then suddenly it does take this twist into the discussion of the power of a local co-op. Is it even handed in how it treats that? Yeah. You know, the co-op as a support to the local community and the co-op
it
potentially.
It actually is, I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I think it is, Sean. I think you're right. I mean, just at the moment in the film, you know, really at one of the kind of key moments in the film, the essentially villain of the piece, I think his character's name is Igel Four. He essentially puts forward pretty good argument for the local people as to why they should support him and not Inga, who we as the viewer have come to support completely when watching the film. Yeah. So I think it, to some extent, it is even handed. But at the same time, it's what's been even handed. I think we're clearly supporting the character of Inga here. Like, this is a film essentially about a little revolution. And it starts with the price of fertilizer, and then it goes on to the price of milk. And it's kind of like a little analogy about some of the problems with industrial capitalism and the way in which large industrial groups are able to control, particularly in this case, farmers and the prices that they're able to set on goods.
Yeah, in some ways, it's looking at the argument of, you know, a very localized, self-contained, self-sufficient economy versus the big global economy, and how does a remote rural area survive within the midst of all of that? But the whole thing, Sarah, is billed as a comedy, which I hadn't seen this beforehand, and I kind of was astonished when I read that it was a comedy.
Yeah, the same here. I'd read that it was from the same director as Rams. The director's work before this, which went well, Boom Big It Can. So I saw this and I thought, wow, like you mentioned, what a really great story of female empowerment, capitalism and rural communities having to compete with larger markets and then the power that the co-ops can have. But apparently it's a comedy, and I'm glad I didn't know that before I saw it. There was nothing here that was unfunny. There was nothing here that was very try hard and fell. But actually, any moments that could be class is comedic. I'm thinking particularly here of a moment when Inga slaps a rake of cow poop on a co-op mafia enforcer's car. She also, using her fertilizer dispenser, plants milk on the co-op's headquarters. And like, maybe that was comedic, but in that moment I was like, right on. What the hell else is she meant to do? She's frustrated to push to her limits. She's trying to make a stand. If it was comedic, well, I didn't find it funny because it seemed in tone with the serious subject matter, a place here, and of course there were moments of levity. You know, it was not, it wasn't, it wasn't a dark, dark film, and there were moments of lightness, but comedy, it wasn't. Not that it wasn't an excellent story.
Stephen,
if this, you know, if this is comedy in Iceland, then I don't know what like their dark dramas are like, you know, because the laughs were few and far between. I mean, some of those were great scenes. I really love the scene where Inga gets to spray the milk on the this office of the co-op, but this is a dark film, you know, even in terms of the way it's lit, and you know, the way the interiors are lit and everything about it kind of brings you to this kind of sparse gray, cold and lonely place. And I was looking to see where the humor was, and it's not that it, like, it, you know, it doesn't lack anything for that. But definitely it wasn't a comedy.
Yeah, and certainly I think there are lots of parallels with rural communities in Ireland. I think you could see that. And we'll all want to go and visit Iceland. Yeah. The Icelandic Tourist Board must be delighted with this film because it looks like a beautiful place to be. Stars from you, Stephen, first this time.
I thought this was a really thoughtful, intelligent cinematic analysis of something in Icelandic culture. It was 4 out of 5 for me.
And what are you saying, Sarah?
I'm saying 4 to 5 as well. Beautiful, atmospheric, lovely, gentle commentary, and a story of a woman essentially finding her freedom despite being shackled by farms and familiar relationships.
Okay, joke. And that's available, I think, is it? I'll just double check that. I think it's Curzon Home Cinema. I'll check that. Yeah, Curzon
Home Cinema. Yes, that's it as well. Yeah, it's available from tomorrow.
Yeah, available
on Curzon Home Cinema.
Right, let's move on then. Two documentaries, actually, and each of you has seen each one of these separately, if you like. First of those is When Women Won, a documentary from Anna Rogers about the Together for Yes campaign in the 2018 referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment. Sarah, you saw this one, funded by the Together for Yes campaign. So I guess we know what perspective we're going to get here.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Together for Yes approached Anna Rogers, an Invisible Thread film, who have also made the story of Yes, about a marriage equality documentary, and that was released a couple years previously. So this is a 48-minute documentary that is tasked with telling a story of the Together for Yes campaign. And so it's first things first, it's told through the perspectives of the... We open with the fact that women believe that it was them who repealed the Eighth Amendment. And yes, in fact, that is true. So throughout this film, it's not just sat with interviews of the people in head office, but it uses a huge amount of archival footage, both from people who are in rural communities, from newspapers, their bloopers and outtakes. And it runs through 35 years... of history in the space of 10 minutes. It really is a complete overview of how this movement came to be and then how it was the referendum came to be won. So within, I think, 10 minutes it was, we had gone from like 1980s up until like 2016, 2017. It really whizzed through a lot of the seismic moments and legal decisions and political outcomes.
Right. Well, let's listen to a clip that gives us a sense of, it gives us a feeling of the 1980s. In fact, Gráinne Griffin from the Abortion Rights Campaign explains what Irish women during the 80s and 90s had to do in order to access abortion.
There was such an incredible silence around abortion in Ireland back then in the 80s and the 90s. Travel to the UK was the only option. I mean, information was currency and it was so very hard to come by. And then combine it with the fact that it had to be carried out in absolute secrecy, it really was incredibly difficult. But women are incredibly resilient and incredibly resourceful. And out of those difficulties, you did see these incredibly inspiring and very much underground movements of women who came forward and organized to help other women. So there were systems, there were numbers, there were names that were passed. There were calls made in phone boxes, ask for a particular person, someone will meet you at the boat, they'll be wearing a red coat. You know, people put women up in their houses, they brought them to clinics. They took strangers in and they helped them because that's what solidarity is and that's what enabling access is and that's what it took. That's what ensured that people could access abortion and did access abortion.
That's a clip there from When Women Won, Gráinne Griffin from the Abortion Rights Campaign. It was the voice that you heard within that. Sarah Taff-McGuire has seen this documentary film for us. As I said, funded by the Yes campaign itself.
Yeah.
So obviously we get one perspective here. Is that a problem? I mean, that it doesn't... I didn't want to rehash the whole debate again.
Yeah,
but
it's not a problem.
Did you need to hear the other side of the argument? Or did,
No, not at all. I mean, why would you need to relive a campaign that was already dragged out over 35 years? That's been done. I think here what they want to say is to capture the movement and what happened and from the people who were there. I think it's not totally just a showreel or promotional material for the campaign. They do want to discuss the reality of it. We do have access to the women speaking candidly about some difficult moments, particularly the poster saga, where people were very annoyed that the No side had their posters up in advance. Orla O'Connor, who's the head of the National Women's Council of Ireland, very frankly says how fearful she was that at the launch of the campaign it was extremely difficult to get public figures to come out and voice their support for a Yes side. So we do hear about the campaign difficulties, but this documentary is 48 minutes long, and I'm not quite sure why it's so short. I know other films like The Story of Yes were of a similar length, and Amnesty did a documentary about the campaign, which is 20 minutes long. But there is just 35 years of history, a dense campaign with involving huge numbers of women and personal stories to fit into such a space of time was, to be honest, a missed opportunity. To maybe, for, as I mentioned, it was a campaign about women all across the country. This could have been a great opportunity to bring women into HQ and go further into why campaigns were launched. They say that the posters, the wording of the posters annoyed people. How was the decision made? So I think a missed opportunity perhaps to allow for reflection, pause, analysis, and instead whizzes through. We heard Gráinne speaking there about the, life in the 80s and 90s, and then she speaks about the founding of the abortion rights campaign. I would have loved to hear a little bit more of this rich, deep story rather than whizzing and rushing through it to give context. I think it would be great to go more behind HQ and hear about those stories.
Yeah, and indeed, I know that you also expressed some reservations around the absence of migrant voices.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, this was a campaign about four women to not even, no political campaign is ever perfect, to not acknowledge that some migrants felt unhappy that how they were particularly really harmed wasn't mentioned, and there was no mention about what needs to be done next. I mean, the 72-hour waiting period, about conscientious objection, there are real issues that the campaign, Abortion Rights Committee, are still working on that aren't really even alluded to as a next step. So I felt it was sort of an artificial cutoff point and a lack of discussion about what the issues are now and what next for the campaign.
You wanted more, but overall, Stars, would you recommend seeing this?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely see it. It's such a feat that Anna Rogers has made what is admitted to be a traumatic, difficult time for women into a beautiful, happy, positive and deeply moving film. So really well done. Excellent production qualities. 3.5 out of 5 because, again, would it like to be less rushed, a little longer, a little more analysis and a little more reflection on what needs to be done now, even 5 minutes on it.
And that'll be available free from the IFI player from 25. IFIplayer.ie. Finally then, Women Make Film. This is from the filmmaker Mark Cousins. We spoke to him about this last year. 840 minutes long in total. I doubt you got to watch all 840 minutes. But basically what's happening in this, it's a series of documentary films really, isn't it, Stephen?
Yeah, it is. It's a series that will be released in 5 blocks of 3 hours. And I was only privy to the first block, so that's 3 hours long. But like, to be honest, Sean, just from watching that block, I was just so pleased to see this documentary. It's really, really, really like timely, an epic documentary, and it's going to influence anybody with an interest in cinema, you know, not just women, anybody at all, for years to come.
Yeah, but essentially, what is the story that Mark's cousin, an untold story that he's telling here of female filmmakers?
This is something he's done before. It's kind of an academic trend anyway that Cousins is, I suppose, he's part of as a film critic kind of on the outside. And his previous documentary series, which was 14 hours long, called The Story of Film and Odyssey, he said that the story of film had been told from a white, male, Western perspective, particularly an American one. So the history of cinema was, to Cousins, racist by omission. And he was quite right. He, in this film, says that, you know, cinema is sexist by omission. And he doesn't say it this time because he has Tilda Swinton and numerous other great ladies narrating the documentary. You know, typically for Cousins, if anyone knows his stuff, like The Eyes of Orson Welles or The Story of Film, his documentaries are non-linear. And I think when I was younger, I had a bit more difficulty with that, but I really respect his, how you know, Cousins analyzes films. That, but at the same time, I have to say that this is not a direct history of women in cinema. And just a quote from Tilda Swinton, you know, she's saying, you know, this is not a film about directors' lives. It's not a chronological history. You know, it's not asking why women's films are better than men's. This is a documentary that wants to show people how women have understood the world through the art of cinema.
Yeah, and in fact, the way he tells the story is rather than chronologically saying, "Well, here's the first woman who made a film, here's the next one, etc., etc." He does it as if it were a film. Here are some great openings.
Absolutely, yeah.
Here are some great middle acts, you know, etc., etc. Okay,
he's definitely more from the Jean-Luc Godard history of cinema school than something more conventional.
Yeah, and I suppose to really appreciate this, every time there's a voiceover narration, it's there's something happening on the screen that's been commented on, so it's quite difficult to get a sense of it without seeing
it really
what's
is.
Happening.
Yeah,
as well
it's incredibly visual. It's incredibly visual. Yeah.
So you'd recommend this, and you'd go for all five parts, I'd say.
Yeah, I would. Like, I'm going to try and see the other parts now. I know some of them were screened in the UK, I think, way back in 2018. But you know, it opens up people's eyes to so many films and filmmakers that they won't have heard of. You know, from the Soviet Union in the 70s, in Kazakhstan, you know, in China in the 50s. And it's really something that will, I suppose, allow, again,
that's
just
great.
A quote from the film, people to look through the cinema through the eyes of women.
That's Women Make Film, a very long series of documentaries, but worth it, according to... did I ask you for stars? I think you're five.
Oh, sorry, Sean.
Five out of five.
This is brilliant. Yeah.
5 out of 5, it's brilliant, says Stephen Boyd. And it's available through the British Film Institute Player and Curzon Home Cinema. They're going to release all five parts on a one part per week basis. Stephen Boyd and Sarah Taff McGuire are film reviewers this evening. Now, no matter what's going on in the world, it's safe to say that crime fiction is one genre that seems to never lose its appeal. Declan Burke has been reading a swathe of new crime novels for us, and he joins me now. And we're starting with Terry Brankin Has a Gun, debut novel from Belfast journalist Malachy O'Doherty. Spoke to us on the programme, in fact, last month about this book, Declan. Terry Brankin, a man in a suit with a dark past, a type that Malachy would know well via his day job, as he's very clearly told me on the night. I remember him speaking to us. Tell me about, because Malachy O'Doherty has written about, you know, journalistically about the troubles in Northern Ireland. Tell me about the character of Terry Brankin.
Yeah, I suppose an anti-hero rather than a hero, Sean. He was once in the IRA, and we're told, and I quote, he was a bomber with a conscience, and he's now a solicitor in post-Troubles Belfast. He is living a fairly comfortable and wealthy life. His past is obviously behind him. And then the reopening of a cold case brings Inspector Basil McKeague to Terry's door with accusations of Terry's involvement in the murder of three civilians in 1985. And as you can imagine, Terry's old comrades are not too impressed by the fact that Terry has been kind of put out on a limb, and especially his former officer commanding Dominic McGrath.
Now, Terry Brankin, and I did that on the night as well. I kept calling Malachy O'Doherty Terry Brankin. Malachy O'Doherty has written non-fiction books. I think it's 8 or 9 he has written, 9th on the way if I have my numbers right. How does the shift from journalist, and it's been done by others, from journalism to fiction work for you? Did he get the thriller aspect of things here, Malachy O'Doherty?
I really thought this is one of the most assured debuts I've read in quite a long time. Sean, he gets, I think, the essence of what it was like to be in the IRA in the early 80s, in the mid 80s, and also is very good at the kind of post-Troubles, the complexity of what it means to be a political powerhouse in that era, or a peace processor, as Malachy describes Dominic McGrath. It's parallel narratives we're dealing with here, very cleverly done, Sean. So we have what's happening in 1985 running parallel to what's happening now, as Terry Brankin is kind of fending off a number of different foes, among them his old ex-comrades and the cold case people. I thought it was really well done. As I say, one of the best debuts I've read in some time.
Right, so you enjoyed that enormously. That's for Declan Burke's first recommendation for you if you're looking for a crime thriller in these lockdown times. Terry Brankin Has a Gun by Malachy O'Doherty. It's published by Merrion Press. Let's move on to Nicola White. Religious martyrdom is the theme in her book A Famished Heart. It brings us back to Dublin in 1892. Very dramatic opening here by any standards. What happens, Declan?
Dublin in 1982.
Sorry, 1982. My mistake.
No problem. So A Famished Heart, as you say, starts out with religious martyrdom. It's a parish priest who is making a courtesy call, and he discovers that two of his parishioners have deliberately starved themselves to death, although or that's what exactly what it looks like, and notes have been left and so forth, and it all looks tragic but above board. And then detectives Vincent Swan and Gina Considine are called in, and they're gradually persuaded, little details persuade them, that maybe the McNamara sisters who starved themselves to death, maybe they were slightly persuaded perhaps to take part in their what's called a devout suicide.
And there's an actual event that is the basis for this story by Nicola White. Not the first time she's done that.
According to the book jacket, this is inspired in part by recent Irish history, the true life tragedy of four women who starved themselves to death in a house in Leixlip, and Nicola White's debut in 2013, as I think you're alluding to, that was also rooted in recent Irish history back in the 1980s. She does a wonderful job of, she's not quite fictionalizing the facts. She takes this as her leaping off point, but this is a wonderful crime of a very unusual. You don't get religious martyrdom, for starters, as a theme, but there's also gothic horror references, and it's very psychologically nuanced. And what really impressed me was that it's a very compassionate account of the McNamara sisters' death.
And this is the first of a proposed trilogy from Nicola White. It sounds as if you've enjoyed the first part and you're looking forward to the second two, or the
Absolutely
next two, rather.
Absolutely terrific. I was looking forward to this because I was very impressed with The Rosary Garden, which is her novel from 2013. And the following two novels are also going to feature the detectives Swan and Constantine. So absolutely, I would advise any crime fiction fans to look out for the name Nicola White.
OK, so that debut novel was in The Rosary Garden, and A Famished Heart is the first then of this new trilogy from Nicola White, and the one that Declan is recommending to us. It's published by Viper. We'll move on to your third choice, Jane Casey, well-established writer at this stage, obviously. The Cutting Place, the latest in the D.S. Maeve Kerrigan series. Tell us a little bit about Kerrigan, this character from Jane Casey, Declan.
Yes, Jane Casey has won awards for this character. I think this is the seventh novel. The Cutting Place opens with a single hand which is discovered on the bank of the Thames. Her Maeve Kerrigan she works for the London Metropolitan Police and has moved up through the ranks over the course of the novels. And soon Maeve is investigating the whereabouts of a missing freelance journalist called Paige Hargreaves, whom Jane describes as having a fearless ability to puncture overblown privilege. And her investigation leads her to the doors of the Chiron Club, which is a bastion of wealth and power, and is frequented by, and I quote, politicians, judges, media, bosses and billionaires.
And in terms of Casey herself, you would say that this is her most political novel to date. What makes this one more political than what she's written previously, do you think?
Well, I think she has always been political with a small p, Sean. This is very much a Me Too novel. It's very much of its time, and it's rooted in those politics. This is about where boorish chauvinism tips over into murderous instinct. And as Josh Derwent, who is, as fans of the novels will know, he's not the most reconstructed male, but he tells me even nice guys will do horrible things if they think no one's going to find out. This is a police procedural that is, as always, is about the personal and political, and Maeve's personal life runs tandem to the events that she's investigating. Again, very cleverly put together, the two narratives are very symbiotic. A great story about institutionalized misogyny that will probably make the reader's blood boil, but that's part of the game.
Part of the reason to read it, I guess. The Cutting Place by Jane Casey, the third recommendation there from Declan Burke, and that one's published by HarperCollins. 50-50 is our fourth novel, Declan, legal thriller this time, set in New York City. But another Belfast author, Steve Kavanagh, going back to the Malachy O'Doherty reference earlier. Kavanagh is a civil rights lawyer. What's the premise in 50-50?
Well, it's very stark. The story begins with two 911 calls, and one is made by two sisters, Sophia and Alexandra, and both of them are calling from the same house, and both are claiming that the other has just brutally murdered their father, Frank, who's the ex-mayor of New York City. Now, the main character in Steve Kavanagh's novels, who's Belfast-based, as you say, but all his novels are set in New York, his main character is a con man turned lawyer, Eddie Flynn, who always prides himself that you can't con a con man, but in this one, he has no way of figuring out which of the twin sisters is guilty of this terrible crime.
Smoke and mirrors involved here. Eddie Flynn himself, there's a kind of an ex-con aspect to this. Does that add to the intrigue?
It adds to the intrigue, and it also kind of... It adds a bit of humour, to be perfectly honest, Sean, which, you know, the courtroom drama can be on occasion a little po-faced and a little dry, and Steve Kavanagh recognises that. I mean, he's won the Gold Dagger Award, he's won the Old Peculiar Crime Novel Award in the last couple of years. He's really revitalised those kind of tropes that might have become a bit moribund with the legal, the courtroom drama, and Eddie Flynn. It's almost as if, you know, Lee Child met Scott Turow, that kind of thing. He gets the blend right.
Yeah, well, Scott Turow will be on the programme with us on Monday, so we'll give you a sense of half of that then, that meeting of minds on Monday's programme. Let me just get 50-50 is your recommendation there, published by Orion Declan. Two other novels that you wanted to mention to us briefly, one set in Mississippi, the other set in Inishowen in County Donegal. Let's go Mississippi first, briefly.
Michael Farris Smith's Blackwood. It's set in Mississippi, very kind of southern gothic feel to it. Fans of Jim Thompson and Cormac McCarthy will both get a real kick out of this. It's about a drifter who returns to the town where he grew up shortly after his two young boys go missing, and of course he is the prime suspect. But Michael Farris Smith is absolutely writes like a dream, and his description of landscape and his interweaving of the past and the present is just fabulous.
Okay, and that's No Exit Press are the publishers of Michael Farris Smith's Blackwood. And finally then, let's get right back home, and The Body Falls by Andrea Carter, published by Constable Inishowen, and that's off where she always is with Benedicta or Ben O'Keefe.
Yes, Ben O'Keefe, who's a solicitor in the small town of Glendara in Inishowen, as you suggest. Ben O'Keefe is very much in the mould of the golden age of mysteries. People who are weaned on the Agatha Christie novels will really like the Andrea Carter novels, I think. Set against the backdrop of a biblical kind of flood, we have a charity boss who's discovered on a mountainside having been killed, apparently by snake bite in Donegal, all of which is shocking enough. What I really like is those kind of tropes of the golden age of mystery, Sean, but set against that kind of raw-boned beauty of Donegal. It's a very intriguing blend.
So obviously St. Patrick left one or two behind in Donegal. So look, it seems as if you've been having a good time in your reading life in lockdown. That's Declan Burke with his recommendations of the latest crime novels for us on this Thursday evening. Stanley Kubrick was one of the most influential and acclaimed directors of all time. Movies such as Spartacus, Paths of Glory were celebrated for their commentary on society and humanity. Dr. Strangelove brought satire to previously unseen levels, while with 2001 A Space Odyssey, he effectively reinvented the science fiction genre. Stanley Kubrick is next in our series of features, which we're calling Where Do I Begin With or Where Do I Start With, where we give you suggested starting points for iconic artists that you might know a little bit of their work, but you want to delve a little bit deeper or get to know it better. And to tell us where he thinks we should start with Mr. Kubrick, I'm joined now by Michael Pope. How challenging a filmmaker is Kubrick to start out with, Michael?
Well, it was quite challenging to pick some of his movies out of his back catalogue, because I could have easily picked three to four others, and it would have been a perfect introduction to the man and his style and his themes and things like that. But I think the more you know about him as a person, I think that can kind of bleed into how you approach his films. I mean, he was born in Manhattan in 1928, and he was a photographer and then a documentary filmmaker. But he had a couple of medium-sized kind of critical hits. From about 1953, between 1953 and 1956, he had Fear and Desire, a very low-budget war film. Then he had a couple of pulpy crime thrillers called Killer's Kiss and The Killing, which kind of brought him to the attention of who would have been a guy who would have been a megastar at the time, which was Kirk Douglas. And Kirk Douglas wanted to he wanted to kind of work with the best director or the new and upcoming directors. So Stanley kind of found this true to life novel based kind of on a report of a soldiers who were executed, French soldiers who were executed during the First World War in order to save face and to kind of boost the morale of the soldiers. And without Kirk Douglas on board, it would have been a very, very difficult picture for a young 29-year-old man to make. But Douglas kind of brought that star power. It had a $1 million budget. Kirk Douglas took a third of that $1 million budget. But without that kind of star power, no studio would touch this kind of somber anti-war picture, you know? It was, but in 1950 particularly, it was bold, heroic, epic, technical or war adventures, you know? This was an anti-war film that was banned around most of Europe at the time.
Right, well, let's have a listen to a clip, in fact, which gives us a sense of the level of debate that he goes into, in fact, a scene involving, in this case, General Brulard, who brings the event. This is the shooting of the artillery having to, the French artillery having to fire on their own troops. He brings this whole idea up with the two men. Adolphe Monjou is playing Brulard. Kirk Douglas, as you mentioned, is Colonel Dax. And George MacCready is playing the character of General Paul Meurot.
Oh, Colonel Dax, your men died very well. Would you like some coffee, Colonel?
Oh, thank you, sir.
Oh, by the way, Paul, it's been brought to my attention that you ordered your artillery to fire on your own men during the attack on the anthill.
I did what? Who told you that?
Well, Colonel Dax came to me last night with a story.
Colonel Dax, I've always known that you were a disloyal officer, but I never dreamed that you would stoop to anything so low as this.
General, I've sworn statements from Captain Nickel, your artillery spotter, Captain Rousseau, the battery commander who refused your order.
I think it's infamous. Absolutely infamous.
Then there's no truth at all in the charge made by Colonel Dice.
I don't see how you could even ask me that.
You cannot imagine how glad I am to hear that, Paul. I'm certain that you'll come through it all right.
I'll come through what?
There'll have to be an inquiry.
An inquiry?
But it won't amount to much. Those things never do. The public forgets.
Public?
You've got to have the right to clear your name. You cannot allow such vile insinuations against your character to go undenied.
So that's it. You're making me the goat. The only completely innocent man in this whole affair. I have only one last thing to say to you, George. The man you stabbed in the back is a soldier.
General Georges Brulard there, played by Adolphe Monjou, George MacCready playing General Paul Meurot, and Kirk Douglas as Colonel Dax. In a clip from, you know, I don't think in the midst of all of that, Michael Pope, we made it clear that we were talking about Paths of Glory as the film you would choose.
Sorry,
as,
I beg your pardon.
The film that you would choose as a starting point for Stanley Kubrick. I guess it's that war aspect that makes it so important for you, is it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Kubrick's most frequent subject, even more than sexuality, which was, you know, almost present in almost all his films, is war. You know, I mean, especially in particular the No Man's Land sequence and the trench sequence. They're kind of you really see that the young director is very much kind of he's methodical and he's clinical and it's never been realized at that. And I think it even as recently as 1917, shot at the World War One movie, we're kind of seeing echoes of that, because the trench and No Man's Land scenes in Paths of Glory are a marvel. The fluid camera movement, it's got this minimal percussive score, the sound design, and the kind of over-the-top strategy is just breathtakingly realized. And this is 67 years ago, directed by a 29-year-old man. So you're kind of getting that there's a kind of a weight of intellect behind even the action scenes and particularly the dialogue scenes and kind of the themes of cowardice versus heroism in World War One.
The other important thing I think is to remember here is 1957 was Paths of Glory. At what point then did he up sticks and say, quite soon after this, and I think before the second film we're going to speak about, he up sticks and got out of Hollywood altogether and came back to the UK. Why did he want out of there?
Well, following on from Paths of Glory, which was very well received both commercially and critically, he was brought on to replace Anthony Mann on Spartacus, which was a huge Technicolor studio picture like the ones I just mentioned. And that was, he wasn't completely out of his depth, but it was the first time and last time he'd ever have be on a film set that he didn't have complete creative control over. And that was you know, it was traumatic for him. And he, soon enough, for the his following film, Dr. Strangelove, he then let, or Lolita, after Lolita, he directed Dr. Strangelove, and he left the US and never returned. Now, it's kind of apocryphal that he was afraid of flying, but I think in more, he was never really a fan of Beverly Hills and Hollywood and the LA scene. He was more at home in the UK as a creative hub with Pinewood Studios and stuff like that, which is where he ended up shooting 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, which is the second film that you're suggesting that we should think about or should go to get a sense of Kubrick. He reinvented science fiction, really, or the science fiction genre on film with this, didn't he?
At the time of its production and release, it was really the most technically and thematically ambitious motion picture that had ever been created or conceived, as far as I'm concerned. And it still is. I mean, it was called The Ultimate Trip at the time because it was just beloved by these kind of counterculture stoners and critics and audiences. It was, you know, it's Kubrick wanted to tell Arthur C. Clarke, who he collaborated with, he wanted to make a film about man's relationship to the universe and was determined to create a work of art that would arouse emotions of wonder and awe and even kind of terror. And I think it all has that. I mean, it's only adapted from a very basic short story by Arthur C. Clarke called The Sentinel about an alien artifact that's found on the moon. But it just, no film had ever portrayed space exploration so realistically, so beautifully. Like, it's, at the time, it was very fanciful, flamboyant kind of pulp sci-fi tendencies, and he kind of got rid of that and brought in this time of this kind of elegant, vivid futurism that it has never been seen before. And we're kind of in the late 60s at the time where television was kind of Land of the Giants and Star Trek. So it this kind of like serious take on it hadn't really been done before.
Yeah, and this is 15 months, just to put it in context, in an historical context, 15 months before Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. Or, if you believe it, 15 months before Stanley Kubrick did the made-up film about Neil Armstrong setting foot on the moon.
I was determined not to mention that.
Well, I was determined to mention it. Let's have a listen to a clip from Space Odyssey. And again, we think that artificial intelligence is something that we're all worried about now and that it was never spoken about before. But of course, it's as old as science fiction itself. And in the clip we're about to hear, HAL 9000, the voice of HAL by Douglas Rain, the computer controlling the spaceship, HAL 9000, has malfunctioned. Dr. Dave Bowman, one of the astronauts, is in a pod outside, and HAL has found out that the two astronauts are thinking that time to get rid of HAL.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, HAL?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, HAL.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Where the hell did you get that idea, HAL?
Dave, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
All right, HAL. I'll go in through the emergency airlock.
Without your space helmet, Dave, you're going to find that rather difficult.
HAL, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Ooh, you don't want to hear those words from the voice of HAL 9000, Douglas Rain there. And it was Keir Dulé, I think is how I say it, Dr. Dave Bowman, the actor playing Dr. Dave Bowman in 2001, A Space Odyssey. The second of four films that Michael Pope has chosen for us this evening to help you get started with Stanley Kubrick and his art. So Paths of Glory, 2001, Space Odyssey. And you know, again, this almost could be from a totally different filmmaker. He seems to be able to do that from film to film. A Clockwork Orange is the next film that you've chosen for us. What aspect of Kubrick does this show us, Michael?
Well, I would argue this is still kind of in sci-fi territory, but it's definitely, well, for me, it's always been a kind of a jet black sci-fi comedy. It's based on Anthony Burgess's 1962 novel, kind of about the nature of evil and free will, and it's got so much iconic imagery in this that it's kind of You know, everyone will know, you know, the outfit of the white shirt, the white trousers, the white braces, the cricket codpiece, the bowler hat, the cane and the fake eyelashes on Malcolm McDowell. And they speak this Nadsat futuristic kind of adolescent slang that's kind of composed of Russian, English and Cockney. And it's got those kind of famous images like Malcolm McDowell with his eyelids forced open and being forced to watch horrific images while Beethoven's blasted over speakers. It's kind of, he was really kind of on a roll at this point in his career where he actually felt comfortable enough to have these complete expressions and adaptations of works from other authors. And they weren't just adaptations, they were kind of reinvigorations and interpretations of the work. And Burgess was relatively happy with how his novel was kind of taken to task. Unfortunately, he wasn't happy with the ending because he felt Alex should have had some redemption. And he wasn't happy because the film itself was removed from cinemas in the UK by Stanley because of some kind of copycat violence acts that was upsetting Kubrick. So he decided to pull the film until 2000 until the year 2000, actually. But they kind of fell out then when he felt like he left Burgess out in the cold to defend his novel and the motion picture itself.
Yeah, because it was banned in Ireland, in fact, in 1973, and the cinema release only came in 2000. But part of that was to do with that battle, if you like, or that dispute between Burgess and Kubrick, you're saying.
They fell out after that, but I think what caused the film to be released in the end was the death of Stanley Kubrick in 1999, and then once he'd passed away, they kind of his estate decided that they could release it, you know.
Right, well, let's have a listen to a clip. Alex, leader, played by Malcolm McDowell, leader of the Droogs. He's in hospital, lying in bed, heavily bandaged, and the psychiatrist, Dr. Taylor, played by Pauline Taylor, comes in to speak with him.
Good morning.
Morning, Mrs.
How are you feeling today?
Fine.
Good. May I? I'm Dr. Taylor.
I haven't seen you before.
I'm your psychiatrist.
Psychiatrist? Do I need one?
Just part of hospital routine.
What are we going to do? Talk about my sex life?
Oh, no. I'm going to show you some slides, and you're going to tell me what you think about them. All right?
Oh, jolly good. Do you know anything about dreams?
Something, yes.
Do you know what they mean?
Perhaps. Are you concerned about something?
No, not concerned, really, but I've been having this very nasty dream. Very nasty. It's like, when I was all smashed up, you know, and half awake and unconscious-like, I kept having this dream. You know, like all these doctors were playing around with me Gulliver, you know, like the inside of my brain. I seem to have this dream over and over again. Do you think it means anything?
Patients who've sustained the kind of injuries you have often have dreams of this sort. It's all part of the recovery process.
Pauline Taylor is Dr. Taylor there, and Malcolm McDowell as Alex in Clockwork Orange, the third of the four films that Michael Pope has chosen for us to get to know Stanley Kubrick. And final choice you have for us this evening. I don't know if you were listening to Ryan Tuberty this morning. You heard about the guy who is by himself in an hotel in Barcelona, I think it is, looking after it. And you immediately think of The Shining when you hear a story like that.
Absolutely.
Are we in pure horror here, or how do you define this aspect of Kubrick's work, Michael?
I think for Kubrick, this was definitely kind of, well, he hoped for it to be his most conventional project. You know, he was kind of taking on the best-selling horror author on the planet at the time, who was just kind of getting all his novels turned into movies initially with Carrie, Stephen King. Kubrick was upset by the failure of Barry Lyndon. It hadn't done well critically or commercially, so he kind of thought this would be a way to just kind of release a quick horror movie and kind of get the audiences and his box office credibility back on side. But as anybody who has seen The Shining will know, it's anything but conventional. It's just got this almost guttural, swallowing evil all over it. I mean there's very little in the way of jump scares, but you know, the Overlook Hotel itself and Jack Nicholson are just kind of, it's one of the creepiest films I've ever made, and it in itself wasn't particularly well reviewed either. I mean, even Variety, Washington Post, New York Times, they all kind of slammed it and said it was just boring, not scary enough, ineffective, lackluster, you know?
Yeah, I think they may have been proven wrong a little bit since that.
Over time,
people realised it was something else. That's Michael Pope with his Where Do I Start with Stanley Kubrick guidelines. Paths of Glory to start out with, go to 2001 A Space Odyssey then, Clockwork Orange after that, and finish up with The Shining. And that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Mark Dwyer. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGall. I will talk to you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1.